Have you sometimes slipped into a really different mode of being than your normal busy, preoccupied, anxious, whatever your normal habits are, way of being? Sort of really relaxed and at ease so that somehow everything feels okay with you and with the world, even if there's painful stuff going on. There's a sort of all rightness to your experience. You feel kind of content with how it is, and where the world somehow feels a bit more vivid and alive than usual, and you feel somehow more part of the world, more connected. I expect so, because I think it's a really normal part of human experience. It's a normal, natural way of being. I associate it most really with experiences of beauty, either in nature or perhaps listening to music, sort of being absorbed in really looking at a painting, but yeah, especially just the natural world. They're all sort of experiences which are sort of partly about the external conditions and partly about the mind I bring to them. So, you can see a beautiful sunset, you can have a really kind of absorbed experience of a sunset. For that to happen, there has to be certain conditions in the atmosphere, in the world, in the sky, outside of you, that are completely beyond your control, outside of me. But I have to be in a receptive frame of mind too. Sometimes it might pass me by. And there's something that happens which is neither the sky nor me, or both. It's about my response to the sky. It's somewhere where you're just sort of, you're not so separate from the sunset. So I think that is, as I say, part of human experience, quite a common thing, though it might not happen as often as we'd like. It can happen in meditation too. That kind of whole relationship to the world can happen when you fall in love, that sort of open-heartedness. It can happen in communication, when you really feel you're really meeting someone, you're really kind of seeing each other, really understanding each other. There's that kind of opening then sometimes too. So it happens a lot to me on retreat. It's a kind of normal retreat mode after I've been on retreat for a few days, meditating a lot more, reflecting on the Dharma, having good quality communication, probably being in silence a lot of the time. You just get those times where just somehow colours become more vivid. The world, it's like someone's turned up the colour knob on the world somehow. It all looks a bit more alive. And somehow the food tastes really delicious, however ordinary it might be. Just somehow everything's a bit heightened. And I feel like I can really take other people in. I think especially in silence, actually. It's like I can really sort of see who people are, and feel love for them, even without really knowing them or having any actual spoken communication. Somehow it seems easy to love. It happens in daily life too, especially on a sunny blue morning like we had today, if I haven't got anything pressing to do, where I can just really sit and sort of sink into myself. Suddenly I notice I'm looking out of my window, and it's not like I'm in a stunningly beautiful place. I do look out over Bishopston. I have got sky and I have got trees, but not a particularly gorgeous tree. But I realise that somehow the movements of the tree have become very fascinating. Or even today I was watching a leaf hanging on a cobweb and just sort of twirling a little bit, and somehow it seemed meaningful. I'm just very interested in that slow movement of that kind of in mid-air leaf, what's going on there. So it's like, yeah, life starts to take on more meaning, more significance. And it's very simple and very ordinary. But very, I feel very alive, and I feel profoundly all right, profoundly fine. Those sort of experiences tend to be very expansive. They can easily kind of open up, expand, become bigger. Certainly if I dwell on it, if I deepen into it, deepen into myself, joy easily arises. I can often just really open into sort of delight with myself and with life somehow, with just being alive in the world. And in that sort of vividness of the world somehow starts to seem a bit more magical, more meaningful, more magical, and less solid, more as though it could be made of light, sort of speaking poetically. It's not like I see it as made of light, but it's sort of like somehow it's got a bit more movement, life, vividness, magic to it. And I feel less separation from the world. I'm not sort of so aware that I'm me with my life and my concerns and there's all of that out there, and it doesn't, somehow I just feel a bit more at one with it all. And if I drop into it more and really explore what's going on, particularly if I just pick up something I'm interested in, like what is my heart? What is the nature of experience of heart now? Or what is the nature of this feeling of well-being? What's it really feeling like? What's its texture? What is love? What is open-heartedness? What's that like? Then... then I can start to feel that there's no edges to that experience of heart, well-being, of love. There's no limit to it. It's sort of like my heart could reach into space or could reach the stars or something. It's sort of like I don't know where the edges of it would be. And if I look, if I wonder about it, then I kind of get a glimpse of there being a different kind of sense of time. It's like... well, my mother-in-law used to call it the alwaysness, and maybe that's quite a good name. It's sort of like this experience might last a second or half an hour or whatever, but it's kind of available to us at any time. It's very ordinary. It's very there. And somehow that's all sort of linked. It's all, kind of like how long it lasts isn't the point, really. It's very, very simple, very, very ordinary. And it's very, very important. It's very important to me to have those experiences in my life. It kind of lets me know I'm on track in my life, like something's going okay. It's very sort of reassuring somehow. It's really what all of my Dharma life is for, in a sense. It's like that's what it's about, is those moments, those experiences, those times when I feel like I've slipped into a different world, in a way, a different realm. In a way, it's what I live for, actually. I put it as simply as that. It's like, that's what makes life worth it for me. That's what it's all about. So you could say, given that it's that important to me, that's my Buddha refuge. It's the goal and the purpose of my spiritual life. It's my sense of how life could be more of the time, my potential. And maybe that's what it's like to be a Buddha. Maybe a Buddha lives constantly like that, in that world, and some. Like that all the time, and more like that. I don't know. What on earth is a Buddha? Our relationship with the Buddha is paradoxical. You can only really know what it means to be a Buddha by becoming one, by becoming a Buddha. You can only know the Buddha by becoming a Buddha. You only really know enlightenment by experiencing it. You can only really, by awakening, know awakening. Yet we need a strong felt sense of the Buddha, what the Buddha is, to steer by, to guide our spiritual lives, our Dharma lives, to let us know when we're on track. We need to know it so well that we long for it. We need to feel the difference between that and our normal mode of being, that you're kind of pulled through the gap between them. You need something to draw us towards the Buddha, that kind of experience, to pull us away from all the other pulls in our life, everything that takes us the other way into a small, entangled, restricted life. And we need to dwell on our goal, if you like, on the Buddha, so that his qualities can grow in us. That's one of the ways it works, in the way that dwelling on metta grows metta, allows metta to grow. It's like that with everything. The Buddha said, whatever you frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of your mind. Whatever you frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of your mind. So if we were to ponder frequently upon the Buddha, the mystery of what the Buddha is, that would become the inclination of our minds. It become what we become. So we need to feel a connection. We need to feel the possibility, that potential in us. We need to feel that we have a relationship with the Buddha. It needs to connect with us somehow. Not be too distant, yet not be diminished into kind of becoming part of the small experience of ourselves that we might normally have. Not be kind of taken on board as part of me, I know what the Buddha is. There's something about keeping alive to the vastness of potential, the vast mystery, and feeling connected, related to that, which is quite a paradox in itself, I think. So what is your Dharma life about? What's it for? What pulls you into it? I think we all have at least a sort of inchoate intuition of something that's drawing us, another possibility, another way of being. And it is kind of impossible to talk about it without diminishing it, without kind of making it sound something smaller and more fixed and more known than it is. I like words like transcendental, sacred, divine, that kind of thing. Manju Vajra, our president, calls it it. You know, it's the kind of mysterious it. We know there's something, but what? You can't really name it. You could call it Buddhahood, you could call it Buddha nature. So if that's all somehow about the Buddha, what is the Buddha to us? What is the Buddha? Who is the Buddha? We're probably most familiar with the Buddha of the Pali Canon. The young hero who leaves his home, goes forth on a great spiritual quest, a great adventure, and who found a sort of lived spiritual answer to the human predicament, the human problem of life and death, and then spent the rest of his life showing the way, communicating with other people so that they could have that lived experience too. So we have a hero myth, and we have a moving example, a really deep, profoundly moving example of a truly, fully human life, what human life could be, a really, truly kind and compassionate, other-regarding human life. I like the Pali Canon Buddha particularly as a sort of symbol of the simplicity and the ordinariness of enlightened experience. There's something so human and so real and down to earth about the Pali Canon Buddha. He's a sort of flesh and blood Buddha, if you like. There's no flashing lights, there's no being lifted onto another plane, into another world, into heaven. There's just bare feet on dusty roads in the heat of India and endless communications with all kinds of people. And his consciousness is clearly very, very different to mine. I intuit, presumably, like my better moments and some, like that and more, and all the time. So the Buddha is both, and I really get this. This is what the Buddha's about for me in a way. He's human and he's more than. He's like us and he's completely other. He's ordinary and he's magical. Somehow, all in the same symbol, the same being. But the more than magical aspect is brought out more fully in the Mahayana sutras than in the Pali Canon. There is a lot of magic in the Pali Canon, actually, but you get a different Buddha in the Mahayana texts. So these sutras, these texts, are from 500 years or so after the Buddha. So they're automatically more imaginal. They're not describing something quite so directly. It's a bit like, you know, our sense of Henry VIII or something. It's like it's only really in our imagination that we kind of know who Henry VIII was. Except that the Buddha left instructions on how to become a Buddha, how to be a Buddha. And people followed them and they did that and they knew. So they did know what Buddhahood was. They knew in their experience that what the Buddha attained, they can attain. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. And out of that, they had this sort of visionary sense of the marvellous otherness of awakening, of enlightenment, of Buddhahood. Something very sacred, something transcendental, something of cosmic significance in the universe. So the Buddha of the Mahayana symbolises all that. The Buddha principle, Buddhahood. This Buddha is very magical, totally non-rational, clearly in the symbolic world, in the world of myth. A world that's very alive, very vivid, very colourful. Probably the food tastes better. It's a world that's less solid than ours. It's a world made of light where amazing things can happen. So it's just out of the rational realm. And it's a very expansive, boundless world. It's measureless. And the Buddha is measureless. The Buddha is in relationship with the whole cosmos. The whole kind of vision is of like zillions of different world systems, like zillions of galaxies out further than we can possibly imagine, all with life and all with Buddhas, all with awakening as a possibility, awakening being communicated. Just everywhere, saying Buddhahood is everywhere, it's in everything. So, for instance, in the White Lotus Sutra that I talked about last week, I told us one of the parables. There's a whole series of stories in this sutra. And I said it's got this kind of psychedelic cosmic framing. So that's more communicating the Buddha, the kind of frame of it all. So it starts off with the Buddha. The whole sutra starts off with the Buddha in a real location. Vulture's Peak. You can go there in India. It's a real place. But then straight away, you've got far too many disciples to fit on Vulture's Peak. You've got like tens of thousands of different types of beings gathered there. So you start to go, okay, this isn't quite normal reality. We're not quite in the historical, rational realm here. And then it rains flowers and the earth shakes and all kinds of cosmic things like that happen. And you kind of go, okay, yeah, something else is going on. And the Buddha meditates and a light ray goes out from him and it illuminates innumerable world systems in every direction, with their Buddha. So there's, you know, yeah, enlightenment is being communicated in all these places. As Ratnaguna says in his book about a different sutra, but the same kind of picture, at once, this vision is like a meditation on the vastness of space. It's an act of devotion and an expression of compassion for all beings everywhere. It's a psychedelic and cosmic version of the Metta Sutta, which says, bring forth unbounded love for all the world, above, below, across, in every way. Love unobstructed. So that sets the scene for the sutra. Then you get the parable of the burning house that I talked about last week, and several other different stories and exchanges and entreaties to recite and preserve the sutra and great praise and devotion and all kinds of different bits like that. Then you get more of this real kind of cosmic Buddhahood going on, because what happens is suddenly this huge stupa, this huge funerary relic tower, completely covered in jewels and treasures, erupts from the earth. And this tower is 5,000 miles high and 2,500 miles across. And we learn that this is the stupa preserving a Buddha called Abundant Treasures, which is rather nice, who's from a past aeon. He's a kind of previous Buddha to the one we know about. So he's from sort of far distant past, further than we can remember. And he's come from an immeasurable distance away as well. So again, he's straight away from this kind of big picture. And he's shown up now, his stupa's appeared, because the White Lotus Sutra is being taught. And he'd made a vow that he was going to show up when that happened. So this is what happens, because that's the way the cosmos works in this world. And naturally, all these kind of tens of zillions of thousands of disciples want to see the Buddha then. It's like, okay, let's see Abundant Treasures, show him. But it's not quite that simple. Something else has to happen first, according to all the pledges, promises and vows of the previous aeon. The Buddha has to do something first, our Buddha, the one who's teaching the sutra. And so he emits rays of light again. So first of all, he emits rays of light which go towards the east, immediately making visible the Buddhas in the eastern region of lands, lands as numerous as 500, 10,000 millions of Nayutas, a Nayuta is apparently 100 million, of Ganges sands. So you see all these in the east, and the west, and the north, and the south, and above, and below, and all the in-between directions. There's that many zillions of world systems, all with their own Buddha. Having been illuminated, we can now see these huge cosmos of Buddhas. They all come here to this world to hear the White Lotus Sutra and see Abundant Treasures, I suppose. That's what they've got to, what's got to happen before we can see the Buddha Abundant Treasures. But before that, our world is miraculously transformed, so it becomes made of jewels and stuff, and there's a whole description of that. So our world gets kind of tidied up and beautified for them, and miraculously has enough space for them all. In fact, there are seats for them all, thrones for them all. So all these Buddhas come here, and then the door can open on the stupa, and we see Abundant Treasures, this past Buddha in all his splendour, sitting on this 5,000 mile high stupa, and he invites our Buddha to join him. So they share the throne in this stupa together. It's completely wacky, and it's actually my favourite bit of the White Lotus Sutra. There's something it says to me about that vastness of Buddhahood, about the way it's beyond time and space. It doesn't matter, the Buddha from the past, the Buddha from the present, they're on the same thrown together, they're somehow linked, they're all part of the oneness of awakening, which is far bigger than we can understand. It's also, it says to me something about how we have to keep opening to the mystery, how you can't pin the Buddha down. You might think you've kind of got a handle on what our Buddha in our world is, what he means, even despite the fact you can't really imagine how many rays of light he can emit and how far that can reach. You might sort of think you've got a sense of that. But actually, there's another Buddha, more than that, beyond him. Abundant Treasures comes from the far, far past and is somehow kind of opens you up to like, no, there's more Buddha than our Buddha. There's more to it than that. So that says something to me too about the nature of Buddhahood, that kind of immeasurable, can't make sense of it, can't really find words for it, can't really know it. There's always a Buddha beyond the Buddha. There's more Buddha than the Buddha. So So there's also a Buddha beyond the Buddha in another sutra, which I want to read part of to you today. It's one of the Pure Land Sutras that we were looking at on our recent rainy season retreat. The so-called Pure Land Sutras, they're actually the sutras of Sukhavati, the happy land, the land of bliss. So you could call them the Happy Land Sutras. These are early Mahayana sutras. I think they're earlier than the White Lotus Sutra. And the third of them is called the Sutra on the Visualization of the Buddha Amitayus, also called the Guangjing for short, because the Sutra on the Visualization of the Buddha Amitayus is rather long. So Amitayus is a Buddha beyond the Buddha. He's a very archetypal Buddha. Amitayus means infinite life or infinite, immeasurable life. And he's actually the same Buddha as Amitabha, who might be better known to you, who's infinite light. So it's kind of the same thing. Infinite life, infinite light, immeasurable, endless, boundless life and light. Or ungraspable, immeasurable, we can't find the words for, ineffable life and light. So this sutra has a story, which you'll need to read the book to find out about, because we're not going to do all of it today. We're picking up the story, it's a good story, where the heroine, Queen Vaidehi, is in prison. Vaidehi. So you can read the book to find out how she came to be in prison. But she's in prison, and in desperation, she's called upon the Buddha. Because she's just, you know, there's nothing else she can do. Her husband's in prison, she's in prison. Life is only suffering, only limitation. So she's called on the Buddha with great faith. And the Buddha, our Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, has miraculously appeared in her cell, in her prison, with his disciples, Ananda and Modgalyana. So presumably she's kind of having a vision, you could say, or maybe magic things can happen and they've actually beamed themselves up into her cell, who knows. And she asks for teaching from them and the Buddha leads her in these visualizations. So we're going to hear about the vision, the Buddha instructing her in visualizing Amitayus. So if you like, the vision of the Buddha is giving her instructions in a further vision. So again, it's this Buddha beyond the Buddha kind of sense to it. So I'm going to read quite a lot of this, and you can take it like a meditation. It's a practice. All these sutras do go on about how you must read, memorize, recite, pass on, preserve, honor the sutras. And I think you could take that literally. They don't really tell you to do much else in the way of practice. So I think this is the practice. This is the way we can dwell upon the Buddha, and that can become the inclination of our mind. We can open to it with our intuitive, mythical mind and let that soak into us, really. It's not always easy. They are kind of pretty wacky pictures. And it's just not always easy to stay with someone reading to you. So it is a practice. You can treat it as a meditation as you would any other meditation. So you can work with the hindrances in just the same way you would in the mindfulness of breathing. You can notice what's going on in you, what's going on in your energies. If you get distracted, you can come back, just like you would with the mindfulness of breathing. So don't worry too much about what you've missed, like you wouldn't worry about having missed a few breaths, you know, okay, where are we now? In a way, you might have missed a bit of the whole kind of picture that we're building up, but you're probably not going to be able to hold the whole picture anyway. In fact, you're almost certainly not, because it's too big for that. It's kind of, in a way, its purpose is to kind of defeat the rational mind that wants to make sense and know what's going on, so you're probably not going to get it. So just come back in, listen to what's being said, and maybe another phrase will speak to you. Maybe something, or like in poetry, there might be a line that just sort of you respond to somewhere. So yeah, don't worry what you've missed. Don't worry generally, and don't try too hard. Don't try and make the pictures happen or anything like that. Just see what sense it gives for you. Often if I'm trying to imagine a Buddha, I don't have any sort of picture of them, of a Buddha. It's more like there's a sense of something amazing being present, or of being held from behind, even being embraced, or just some vague sort of like, whoa, there's something mysterious more than I'm normally able to perceive. What's it like to go into that part of your mind that can respond to images without having language for it? What would it be if you could sense that bit of you? As Ratnaguna says, the sutra is not a textbook containing facts about existence, but a meditation manual. So that's the way to approach it. Or as one of my friends once said to me, Lakshmalamalini, you've got a poet and you've got a scientist. When you're meditating, you need to check you're doing it with the right one. So, so know before you start, it doesn't make sense and it isn't really possible to see what it's telling you that you have to see really accurately. Don't worry about that. Couple of terms in case you don't know. Mount Sumeru is the king of mountains. It's the kind of centre of the Buddhist cosmos, the biggest mountain in the centre of the world. And Ayodhya is about 8 or 9 miles. So that's just a measurement. So I'll read this through and I'll leave some gaps so you can settle with it. And then after that, I think we'll have groups, and then we can have tea after groups today. So just a couple of minutes to settle into yourself. Relax, be willing to be entertained. And perhaps just set the intention to stay as present to yourself as you can. The Buddha then said to Ananda and Vaidehi, "Listen closely. Listen closely and reflect carefully on what I am about to tell you. I will give you a Dharma teaching on how to free yourself from suffering and from the defilements. You should bear what I am about to say in mind and spread this teaching widely, sharing it with a great many living beings. As he spoke these words, the Buddha Amitayus appeared in the air above him, with the two great beings, Avalokiteshvara and Mahasthenaprakta, on either side. They were blazing with light so brilliant that it was impossible to see them properly. Even the radiance of gold from the Jambu River, multiplied 100,000 times, could not compare with it. When Vaidehi saw the Buddha Amitayus, she bowed down at the Buddha's feet and said, "Blessed one, through the power of the Buddha, I have now obtained a vision of the Buddha Amitayus, along with his two attendant bodhisattvas. Please tell me how living beings in the future can visualize the Buddha Amitayus along with his two attendant bodhisattvas." The Buddha said to Vaidehi, "Those who wish to visualize this Buddha should gather their attention and focus their minds on a lotus flower made of seven kinds of precious substances growing from the earth. They should picture each petal of this lotus flower as being the colours of 100 different kinds of precious substances, with 84,000 veins running through it. Light shines forth from each vein in the 84,000 colours, like a heavenly painting. They should be able to see all of this clearly. The smaller petals of the lotus are 250 yojanas long and 250 yojanas wide. The lotus flower has 84,000 large petals, and it is adorned with jewels, kings among gems, which shine between each of its petals. Each of these jewels radiates 1,000 rays of light. This light is like a canopy made of precious substances which covers the whole of the earth. There is a platform on the lotus flower made of jewels, the like of those worn by Chakra, and adorned with 80,000 diamonds, rubies, Brahma jewels, and wondrous nets made of jewels. Four pillars, decked in banners made of precious substances, arise naturally and spontaneously from the platform. Each of these banners, made of precious substances, is as big as 100 quadrillion Mount Sumerus. Above these is a canopy made of precious substances, like the one in the palace of the heaven of the Yama gods. It too is adorned with 50 billion fine and wondrous jewels. Each of these jewels emits 84,000 rays of light. And each ray of light shines forth in 84,000 shades of gold. The golden light covers the ground made of precious substances, and everywhere takes on different forms. Diamond platforms, nets made of jewels, or clouds of different kinds of flowers. As it spreads throughout the 10 directions of space, it takes on whatever form one wishes and performs the action of a Buddha. This is the 7th visualization, where the mind is focused on the lotus seat. The Buddha then said to Ananda and Vaidehi, "When you have obtained a vision of these things, you should then focus your mind on the Buddha. Why should you do this? The body of all the Buddhas is the realm of reality, and they enter into the focused minds of all living beings. Therefore, when you focus your mind on the Buddha, your mind takes on the characteristics of the Buddha. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. The ocean of all the perfectly awakened Buddhas arises from the focused mind. Therefore, you should concentrate your attention with an integrated mind and visualize the Buddha, the Tathagata, the Arhat, the perfectly awakened Buddha, with great care. When you focus your mind on the Buddha, you should begin by focusing on his form. Whether your eyes are open or closed, you should be able to see his image sitting atop the lotus like a jewel, the colour of gold from the Jambu River. When you can see the image of the Buddha sitting there, your mind's eye will open, and you will be able to see him completely clearly. You will also see the adornments of Sukhavati, which are made of the 7 kinds of precious substances, the ground made of precious substances, the ponds made of precious substances, the rows of trees made of precious substances, the heavenly cloth made of precious substances draped over the trees, and the abundant nets made of precious substances which fill the sky. Visualize all this completely clearly, so that you can see it all as distinctly as if you were looking at something in the palm of your hand. When you have attained a vision of all this, picture a great lotus flower to the left of the Buddha, exactly the same as the first one, and another to his right. Focus your mind and visualize the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara seated on the lotus seat to the left. Picture him radiating golden light just like the Buddha. You should then focus your mind on the image of the Bodhisattva Mahasthanapraptah seated on the lotus seat to the right. When you have successfully focused your mind in this way, picture the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas radiating exquisitely beautiful light. This golden light illuminates the trees made of precious substances. There are three lotus flowers under each tree, and on these three lotus flowers sit the images of a Buddha and two Bodhisattvas. That Buddha field is filled with such images. When you have successfully focused your mind in this way, you will hear the streams of water, the rays of light, all of the trees made of precious substances, the cranes, the Hangsa geese, and the ducks, all proclaiming the wondrous Dharma. Whether you are absorbed in samadhi or not, you will always hear the wondrous Dharma. When you come out of samadhi, you should remember what you have heard, bear it in mind, and not forget it. Check whether what you have heard accords with the sutras. If it does not, you should regard it as a false mental construction. If it does accord with the sutras, you should regard it as a general perception of Sukhavati. This is the eighth visualization, where the mind is focused on the images of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. If you practice the visualization in this way, you will free yourself from the effects of previous extremely serious unskillful actions which you have performed over the course of countless hundreds of millions of aeons. And in this life, you will attain the samadhi of the recollection of the Buddha. This is the correct way to perform the visualization. Doing it in any other way is not correct. The Buddha then said to Ananda and Vaidehi, when you have successfully focused your mind in this way, you should then visualize the body, the major physical characteristics, and the radiance of the Buddha Amitayas. Understand, Ananda, that the colour of the body of the Buddha Amitayas is 100 quadrillion times more brilliant than gold from the Jambu River in the heaven of the Yama gods. The height of the Buddha's body is a number of yojanas equal to the number of grains of sand in the river Ganges, multiplied by 60 quintillion. Between his eyes there is a tuft of white hair that curls to the right, 5 times as big as Mount Sumeru. The Buddha's eyes are as clear as the pure, limpid waters of the four oceans. Light as magnificent as Mount Sumeru radiates from every pore on his body. The sphere of the Buddha's radiance envelops 1 billion world systems, each containing 1 billion worlds. Within the sphere of his radiance, there are a number of emanation Buddhas, equal to the number of grains of sand in the river Ganges, multiplied by 100 trillion. Each of these emanation Buddhas in turn is attended by an assembly of emanation bodhisattvas. Buddha Amitāya has 84,000 major physical characteristics, and within each of these there are 84,000 minor physical characteristics. Each of these emits 84,000 rays of light, and each of these rays of light illuminates all of the world systems in the 10 directions of space, shining upon all of those living beings who recollect the Buddha without exception. It is impossible to describe his physical characteristics, his radiance, and his emanation Buddhas, but by recollecting them and focusing one's mind upon them, it is possible to see them clearly in one's mind. Those who see these things in their mind in this way will see all of the Buddhas in the 10 directions of space, and this is therefore known as the Samadhi of the Recollection of the Buddhas. Those who perform this visualization will attain a vision of the bodies of all the Buddhas. By attaining a vision of the bodies of the Buddhas, they will perceive the mind of the Buddhas. The mind of the Buddhas is great compassion, an unconditioned compassion that embraces all living beings. Those who perform this visualization will be born in the presence of all of the Buddhas when they die, and attain patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen. Therefore, those who are wise should concentrate their minds and perform the visualization of the Buddha Amitāya with great care.